Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about the book Voices of the American West. And Robert Knott will not be with us this week. I'm very happy now to welcome Lanjur Abukusomo. He is the pastor of the Washington Chapel Christian Worship Center in Roswell, New Mexico. He's the founder and chairman of the Blackdom Memorial Foundation, and he will be here on Sunday, January 31st, for an event, a lecture, part of the New Mexico History Museum lecture series called The Blackdom Community, African Americans in New Mexico, and that will include a performance by the Afro Gospel Praise Experience. It's at 2:30 this coming Sunday. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So Blackdom was a township in southern New Mexico, and it was founded as part of a larger migration of black Americans who went west to escape Jim Crow. Tell us about this period in our history.
Well, the onset and insurgence of African Americans into New Mexico was certainly a part of a larger event. Many of the areas included Kansas and Nicodemus, places in Oklahoma, places in Texas, where small townships and small communities sprung up with two things in mind. One was self-determination and political advantage, and two, safety in numbers. Remember, we came out of slavery with the Emancipation Proclamation and then entered into the Jim Crow area, and that caused the migration of ex-slaves and freed men across the United States at large, really.
The conditions in the South from which these ex-slaves were escaping were really terrible. I mean, there were people trying to go into professions and teaching and so on, and they were just horribly oppressed in the South.
That's correct. As a matter of fact, many of the things that were a part of the slavery process were continued on after the Emancipation Proclamation was actually in effect. As a matter of fact, if you know anything about Juneteenth, the slavery was continued another 2.5 years in Texas before that was actually discontinued legally.
When I was watching the documentary that was made about Blackdom, KNME TV in Albuquerque made a documentary some years ago, and it really beautifully portrays that moment of hope and that hope being so very quickly dashed for people who were no longer slaves.
Yes, if you go back in the history, people like Daniel Gibson and Elvis Fleming and certainly Maisha Baton out of the University of Mexico have really painted a fairly comprehensive picture in terms of what was available with regard to the history. The idea was that people were moving, people were exchanging views, and they were still held as sharecroppers because though they were free, they didn't have anything. There was no job, there was no advent toward any kind of educational process, any kind of process where they could move into a particular business or a particular job function or anything like that. It was held back by design so that they could continue to use the individuals as free labor.
And the promise of land was also broken.
The promise of land was broken, and really it was the Homestead Act of 1862 that turned that around. Because then, if you go back, Henry Boyer was one that had come to New Mexico to fight in the Mexican Wars with different army groups. And he had seen the vast areas of land. And then when he took that into consideration with the Homestead Act, he saw the advantage of being able to come out to a land, carve out a section of that land, and then have the freedom to benefit from the results of labor and from the results of your ingenuity.
So tell us about the life of Frank Boyer, Henry's son, and the founder of Blackdom.
Well, Henry had seen this, but was never able to bring it to fruition. And Frank Boyer and Dan Keyes walked from Pullman, Georgia, to the Pecos Valley. That was in part because they couldn't obtain tickets for fares, and because they were really prohibited to a large extent from leaving a particular area and going to an area that sought more freedom. Francis Boyer came to New Mexico in, I believe it was 1896 or so, and he was here. He brought his wife in 1901, and he and Dan Keyes began to formulate the process of bringing other individuals to New Mexico to participate in the Homestead Act. Matter of fact, he provided for areas of refuge and for sustenance to them, to people coming in. When they got here, they were over in an area very close to Dexter, New Mexico. And he went back to Pullman, Georgia at one point and manufactured flyers and built a networking of individuals that would pass the word that there was this kind of opportunity available in New Mexico. And so people came from all over to be in this. Some of the people were the Ragsdales and the Collinses, came from all over to participate in not only the Homestead Act, but the idea of having a town site and a township that they could then parlay into self-determination and things that would give them an equal footing with anybody else.
Now, this Francis Boyer, Frank Boyer, I mean, can we just go back to this thing that you said a moment ago? They walked from Georgia to New Mexico.
That's correct.
That's unbelievable.
That is unbelievable. As a matter of fact, these were not just some individuals who didn't have a lease on education. These were educated persons. They were educated in Morehouse College. And so they had an advantage and a different viewpoint, a different perspective on what they were doing. And yes, if you listen to, for example, one of the descendants, Hobart Boyer in Albuquerque, he speaks about the idea that they would catch them on the road and they would fire their guns at them and make them dance and all these kinds of things. He speaks about that, but we have to understand that these were not uneducated, ignorant individuals. They were very, very, very sharp. As a matter of fact, there was a gentleman I met in Hagerman, New Mexico. Hagerman is right next to Dexter and right adjacent to the Blackdom area. And I went there to see if there was anyone there who had any information on Blackdom. I'm not from this part of the country, and I had very little information on Blackdom. So I went there and asked if anyone knew anything about Blackdom, and a gentleman stepped forward and said, yeah, well, I do. And he told me one thing that was really, really interesting. He said, I asked him how he knew about Blackdom. He said, well, my dad owned the spread right next to it. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, we used to go over there and trade once a week. And as we traded, he said that the woman there, and he had a nickname for her, which I don't recall at this point, but he said she made the best pies in the county. And we used to trade, my dad would trade, and we'd bring water and all of that. And he said, and I learned my letters there. Well, initially, I didn't know really what that meant, and I thought about letters. And I realized that he learned to read in black. I said, why would your dad take you to an African-American settlement for you to learn to read? He said, because they had the best teacher in the county. I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, these guys were really extraordinary. They could teach you to read in half the time anybody else taught you. And they were just really, really smart. Well, I didn't know the magnitude of that until I met Ragsdale's part of the family up in Denver and talked to them, and they came down here, and we went out to the site. They still own their parcel of land out there. And I realized that these individuals were extremely intelligent. And I don't mean that they had a lot of knowledge so much as I mean their ability to process information was extraordinary. So those are some of the things that came out of this Francis Boyer venture.
So Boyer and Keyes came out. How did they identify the land that became Blackdom and then found a township there?
Well, what they did was they located themselves near Dexter. They, I would imagine, now this is not documented, but I would imagine they went to the county courthouse, looked through the records to see what the available land was. I mean, you can do that today. That's how I found the records on Blackdom and the maps on Blackdom. And as a result, you can determine who owned what, and everything is fairly well consistently organized. They would have gone to the county courthouse and seen what was available, and then they would have looked at the actual site and gone out to see where they could actually have the best advantage. And because they were farmers, that took them over toward Dexter. And Dexter, of course, is near the river. I shouldn't say near the river, near water source. You have the idea where they're formulating this, they're building this, they're sending out documents to get people to come to this area, and then they're looking at the advantage of one location over another with regard to what they're going to farm, how they're going to raise it, the immediacy of access roads and those kinds of things. So I would determine that they would have looked at those things in terms of looking at where and determining where they would actually set up.
Once the community was established, people started coming out to join it.
Yes.
How did they survive?
Well, for one, Francis Boyer and Ella Boyer, his wife, would maintain them at their location, give them foodstuffs and help them build, i.e., build the house on the area that they were homesteading until they could get on their feet. Francis Boyer had a fairly deep well, and so he had enough water to make what crops he was growing flourish, and he would then share that. As a matter of fact, there was a segment that I remember reading where his grandson had said that he refused to hoard, keep what he would obtain in terms of harvest, and he would always share that. And therefore, when he came to the foreclosure on his property, he didn't have the wherewithal, financial substance, to offset that, and that's why they foreclosed. But it was because he did these other things for everyone that came in, trying to build this community, that he was in that position.
How long did the community last?
They were there 1896, I believe, is the date that is consistently used, and they were there until the mid 1920s.
And so during that time, how did the community thrive? What were their challenges? What was it like?
Well, initially they didn't thrive. Initially, it was very difficult, except that when they did obtain water from that well, they then had a period of flourishing. They would grow apples, alfalfa. They had some very, very decent methodology because they came out of a sharecropping, out of a farming background. And so they would develop these things, these products, and then sell them or trade them for what they needed. So it was a barter system and a selling system that they engaged in.
It's interesting. I mean, coming from the South, and having just horrible relationships with their white neighbors who were still resentful about having lost the Civil War. What were their relationships? I mean, you alluded to it a while ago. Some of the, I guess, white neighbors learned to read and write in Blackdom. What was the relationship like with the larger community? Did they catch any racist tendencies, or was it better than that?
Well, essentially, no. It was much better than that. They had a community that, for example, when they had their Juneteenth celebrations, the cowboys would come up, and they'd have baseball games against each other, and they'd share foodstuffs and all of that. As a matter of fact, if a cowboy was coming up, or a group of them coming up, they would actually stay in the homes of the settlers, of these pioneers. And so there was a good relationship between them. It wasn't until there was an influx of Easterners, Southern Easterners, actually, that came in with the same mores and same prejudices that they had had, that they ran from, that the pioneers had run from, that things began to become strained. And so that didn't help.
What happened then?
Well, what it did is it made everything difficult. It made, for example, where they were able to go and get water, because they had to, when the wells went down, they had to wagon water in. Then you had problems with that, and they would do things against them. But we don't dwell too much on the negatives that were done, because they did overcome that. They overcame that, other than the fact that the banking system would not provide them financial sustenance to go for deeper wells where they would have had water. And then there was, in one of the documents, there's the idea that the county passed a law that you could not drill any other wells, artesian wells. And so that was the coup de grace, as it was, that caused the demise, because even if they then at that point had been able to get funding, they could not legally drill the well.
And so eventually the community, for reasons really of water, fell apart. Where did the residents of Blackdom go?
Well, a lot of them had to augment what they did as farmers with a number of things. They would become laborers. They would do sharecropping. They would work in some of the hotels that were in the area and those kinds of things, menial type jobs, just to offset the lack of funds that they had. Then, when of course it came to its demise, they went to Hageman, they went to Dexter, because they knew people there and had worked there. They went to Roswell, they went to Vado and Las Cruces, they went to Picacho. They went to those areas, and it was over a period of time. I think they said the Boyers were, I believe, either the Boyers or the Collinses were the last ones to leave. I think it was the Collinses. And they went up to Roswell and developed a lifestyle in Roswell.
Have you been able to determine the legacy of Blackdom, of the community there, on New Mexican culture, on Southern New Mexican life?
Somewhat, but remember, the African-American pioneer that came out of that era, out of that quagmire of water loss and the loss of properties and having to sell off properties and on and on and on, they had to take very menial, very invisible type jobs. So there wasn't a detailed record of exactly what they did and how they did it and how they overcame certain issues. They were very resourceful people. We've seen that in some of the positions they had in the Roswell area. And we've seen that from some of the descendants in the Roswell area, having musical backgrounds and all those kinds of things.
A documentary was made, which I was just watching on YouTube, about Blackdom. It was made in, I think, 1997 for KNME TV. What what were the historical documents that people who have studied blackdom, documents, artifacts that have remained to allow us to reconstruct a picture of that time?
Well, I remember that documentary that you're talking about, Cortez Williams and some others in the university had
right.
been responsible for that. I remember that. For example, one of the things that we mentioned before was the Baptist church that doubled as a schoolhouse. Well, that was purchased and then resold. It's now down in Cottonwood. We've been there. It is refurbished into a residential property, and we would like very much to obtain that on the site that we're building. Some of the things that were done to re-establish the linkage between now and then were the records from the oil companies that purchased the land from many of them, all of the documents in the county records, to include platting, to include letters of agreements and all of those things. The records that were involved in the lawsuits from the individuals there with individuals that were either trying to obtain the land or whatever the fracas was about, those documents are still available. There are photographs that are available both in the Historic Museum, the Southwest History Museum here in Roswell. And there are accounts by individuals, which is probably the most colorful of all of it. Helena Collins gave accounts of her family and what they did and how they did it. Her brother was instrumental, and he's passed now, but he had just tons of information that at the time nobody thought was important to obtain from him. You've got... for example, there's a descendant in our church, Christina Wagner, whose great-grandfather, Lonnie K. Wagner, was out there, and she has information on different aspects. The Carver School that was made to provide for a segregated educational system because there was no law to prevent the establishment of having the ethnic groups educated simultaneously or in the same location. So they built the Carver School, and there's a whole history on the Carver School, for example, and what those things were about that you really have to obtain from the individuals themselves. Now, we've done some recording and some videoing of that because we want to have an interactive media center in the museum, in the complex, that will provide for that.
I think one of the things that's so interesting about this whole history of blackdom, besides the charismatic characters and the history of the South, it kind of highlights a subculture within New Mexico that doesn't really get talked about much. We're talked about as a tricultural state, and the whole black and post-slavery contribution to New Mexico is ignored a lot of the time, and blackdom really brings that out.
That's correct. There's a number of reasons for that, however. African Americans, by and large, don't infuse themselves into the community events and affairs like you would see in, say, a New York or L.A. or somewhere like that, principally because there's a legacy of taking positions that are very invisible because there was a protection. And it kept certain things from happening to you or certain problematics that would come up because you were in or out in the open. So that has a residual effect. That still tailors a lot of the community, African-American community's response to a lot of things. And one of the things that we're saying is that not only does the other community have to be educated, but the African American community has to be educated as well, so that we become aware of exactly who and what we are and where we've come from, and that by that can determine the things that would orchestrate where we go.
So a museum would definitely contribute to that visibility of that heritage.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Roswell has a heavy, heavy tourist aspect to it in terms of its industry. That's probably the main industry, that milk, you know, the dairies. African Americans don't participate in, for example, UFO, alien, and all of that. We don't do that too awfully well. We're not orientated to that kind of affair, by and large. Now, there are some of us who do that, yes. But right. By and large, as a community, we don't. We kind of shun from that. But this, what we see, is that the African American nationally would see this as a pristine way to find out what the culture was. What the pioneers in this area did, and that would lend itself into the tourism in the community. So you would then have an interchange between the ethnic groups, so that they would see that there were things that these pioneers did that need to be in the forefront of American history. There are things that they accomplished that were virtually impossible at that time. So those are the things that we want to bring forward, and those are the things that will teach us and link us to each other.
Lanjour Obukusomo is the pastor at Washington Chapel Christian Worship Center in Roswell, New Mexico. He's the founder and chairman of the Blackdom Memorial Foundation. And once again, this coming Sunday at 2 o'clock at the New Mexico History Museum, he and others will be there giving lectures about Blackdom. And the Afro Gospel Praise Experience will be performing as well. I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'm working on the building. I'm working on the building. Yes, that's a true foundation. Tired, I'm holding up a good time. Got a blood stain, and a further blowstain. Got a feeling of heaven, I'll never get tired. While I'm working on the building, I'm gonna run on to heaven. Oh Lord, to get my reward. Well, sometime I'm preaching. Don't you know, but I'm working on the building. Oh, I'm just holding up a blood to banner for the Lord. Well, child, I'll never get tired. While I'm working on the building, oh Lord, I'm busy forming on the heaven. Oh Lord, to get a sometime I'm crying, you know, but I'm working on the building. Well, I'm just holding up a blood, the bloodstained banner for the Lord. Oh yes, I'll never get tired. I'm working on the building, I just run on to heaven. Oh Lord, to get my reward,
I'm a reward.
Well, I'm working on the building.
Blessed and the woman, 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 bless
I'm very happy now to welcome Corinne Platt. She is co-author of the book Voices of the American West, and she and collaborator and photographer Meredith Ogilby will be at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, January 30th at 2 in the afternoon right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So this is a wonderful, big, heavy, delicious book full of photographs and verbal portraits of people, characters here in the American West. How did you and Meredith start this whole project?
There's a long story behind it. Meredith was looking at doing a project, and she was inspired by several men she knew who lived in the mountains, who were older, who were very humble and very helpful in their communities. And she thought to herself, my God, I have to tell these stories. And we unexpectedly reunited. We were friends, and I helped her with her first book at a Western conference. And she told me what she was doing, and I was interested in writing about environmentalists and what was going on in the West and kind of more in the environmental scope. And we just joined forces, and we started, and that was that. We just wound our way into it.
So how did you start? Who was the first person whom you interviewed? Now, I want to say that the text in this book is not essays by the people whom you portray. It's conversations with them, but kind of with you guys taken out and the people themselves really speaking. But it has very much that spoken sense to it.
That's correct, yes. And we intentionally did that because we wanted this book to be about other people's voices, their words, their stories, and kept ourselves out as writers to refrain from kind of offering that subjectivity. But back to your question, we began with Stuart Udall, which was very inspiring and very scary. A friend, Ed Marston, who is also featured in the book, and is the former publisher of High Country News magazine, journal, introduced us to Stuart when we told him our idea about the project, took us to his home, and we sat with Stuart, who lives in your area, and I believe is turning 90 right about now. And we sat with him and talked about his experience as the Secretary of the Interior under John F. Kennedy and his whole philosophy about the West.
And where did you go from there?
From there, we sat in a car and bent Ed Marston's ear and wrote all sorts of notes, and he gave us names and contacts. And I had in mind several people who I wanted to speak with, and Meredith had in mind several people she wanted to speak with. But I believe after we spoke with Stuart, we went home and we got our act together. We contacted people and did our research and probably headed out on our next trip 2 or 3 months later. I can't remember off the top of my head where that was.
The bent of the book is very much toward a kind of conservation and a sense of the West as a place that's both full of incredible natural riches and also very much under attack. And you were, it seems like that's the binding theme to the very many diverse people whom you chose.
I think that's right. I think one of the areas Meredith was very interested in was the ranching communities and what was going on in the kind of the new ranching world, as it were. There's a lot of organizations and individual ranchers who are bringing new information and experiments to their ranches to try to not only save their land, because they really are wonderful stewards of the land, but to keep themselves and their families on the land and keep them ranching. And I think as we learned more and more, we realized that ranchers are incredible conservationists, all of them, everyone we spoke with anyway. And that was a big theme in our book.
Well, that runs counter to a lot of the thinking of at least some conservationists who see ranching. I mean, there's all sorts of battles about ranching on public land and the real problems associated with overgrazing.
Absolutely. And I, believe it or not, I was very much an anti-rancher when we started this book. I really believe they degraded the land and don't have a place in the West. And as I spoke to more and more ranchers who were working creatively, and applying different land conservation techniques, my attitude really changed. And I have to tell you that some of the ranchers we spoke with are the kindest, most humble people, and they know more about the land than any environmentalist. That I believe. And then Courtney White, who is right in your area as well in Santa Fe, runs the Kavir Coalition, and we went to one of their conferences and were able to learn about what a lot of ranchers are doing on the ground, which that are making a big difference.
Yeah, and we've had Courtney White on this program talking about his book Revolution on the Range, in which amazing things are happening. But it is an interesting thing, because ranchers are, at least many of them traditionally, very conservative people, and they don't like to change the way they're doing things.
I think that's absolutely right. And I spoke with a fraction of the ranchers who are on the land, and I'm sure there are people like that still. But it seems as though there's a movement underfoot, and people are joining on because they really do care about the land. In contrast to that, we have a man in the book named John Marvel, who's with the Western Watersheds Program up out of Idaho. And he's very bold and brazen, and really believes that no cows should be on Western lands, period. So we have his perspective in the book as well, which is something that we tried to do, which is, again, I offered that we try to keep ourselves and our opinions out of the book as much as possible and present different perspectives on what's happening in the West today.
So one of the things that I thought was interesting in the book was people who were talking about how our land use and zoning rules can be very destructive to the ranching life and really basically favor giant suburbias and basically favor development.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. That is what a lot of people are concerned about in the West, and they're working very hard to keep that from happening, you know, be it off helping ranchers maintain conservation easements or obtain conservation easements so that they can actually hold on to their land, because it's so expensive for them to keep it. Ranching, they're not making that much money, and it's so expensive for them to hold on to it, and they end up having to sell their ranches because, as several people talk about, the kids, you know, that grew up on the ranches don't necessarily want to ranch. They want to go to the cities, and they want to have different kinds of opportunities. And it's very hard for those families to, A, lose that sort of family tradition, but and B, see their land go to other uses like development.
As I was reading this book, and there are so many different people portrayed, it's not a book that you read from beginning to end. You sort of flip through it, and a picture or a name or a paragraph pops out at you, and you read that. All the little portraits are just a couple of pages at most. But one of the things that struck me is that for people who are demoralized and who are looking for role models and looking for success stories and just different ways of addressing the environmental problems we have, this is a wonderful resource.
Absolutely. And I think as Meredith and I began, you know, the process evolved, and as the book grew and grew into what it was, I think that was our big hope, is that people would read it and feel hopeful and feel inspired that maybe they could do something to make a difference as well. You know, even if it's a small, you know, something. We're not talking about recycling, but it's, I think what people offer in this book are different ways to live your life that are, you know, working on problems and trying to come up with solutions, and they're all very hopeful.
Now, one of the people you interviewed was the head of the company Patagonia. And I found that interview that conversation very interesting, because this is somebody who wasn't a business person, didn't mean to go into business, and didn't hire anybody who has an MBA or any business background at all. So they break all the rules.
He breaks all the rules, and he says that several times. And he says, I love it when he says, I think businessmen are real greaseballs. And he says that over and over. But as he found himself a businessman, he realized he was going to be in business for a while. He decided to create a company that would break all the rules and exist as a way to change business policies. And ironically, or whatever, as he says, everything he's done to try to preserve resources has made him more money.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
It totally goes against the common practice. In other words, that if you're going to do something that's environmentally sustainable it's going to cost you more as a company.
Absolutely, and I think he's such a good example of somebody who, or he's showing us that that doesn't have to be the case. And I do believe a lot of companies are following his lead. I really do. There's a lot of companies out there that are, you know, reducing, you know, reusing, recycling, using that motto. They're doing a good job.
What were some of the biggest adventures you had doing this project? You interviewed dozens of people.
Well, one of the great things I think I speak about it when I wrote the introduction is we went to a commune to visit a fellow named Charles Ford. And Meredith and I, neither of us had been to a commune before, and his directions to get there were so funny. I mean, we were in the middle of nowhere, actually outside of the Gila Mountains right there in New Mexico, and it was the Mimbus Hot Springs commune. And, it was just funny getting there, and his directions said, you know, something about you can't see the house from the road, but look for the 1951 Plymouth with weeds growing out of it, and then take the next left or something, you know. And then we had other adventures where we would always stop and take a hike here and there, and, you know, we hiked up into this area where there's some Anatolian sheepdogs that chased us down into a field of cows, and the field of cows chased us into an old homestead, and we just laughed our heads off. I mean, we had a great time. We had a great time together doing this book. Always on the road. We never flew. We just would, you know, organize our interviews in certain areas, and then we'd hit the road, and we'd try to meet with, four or five or six people at a time.
One of the subjects that comes up, which is continually a controversy in New Mexico, is the subject of wolves and the reintroduction of wolves onto land where there's ranching going on. What did you learn about that subject?
Wow, did we learn a lot. I created in the book a wolf triptych, I called it, and it has three different perspectives on the wolf issue. One is from more of a biology perspective about how wolves have benefited the environment, for everything from the elk populations down to all the little flora and fauna, and how they're really part of the natural cycle. On the other side of that, we interviewed a man who sued the federal government over the reintroduction of the wolf because his ranch was taking such a hit from the wolves. And I learned a lot there. I didn't necessarily agree with this man, but he had a real problem, and his ranch manager had tried to come up with several solutions and took those to the government, and they weren't really having much luck. So, again, I didn't really agree with his perspective, but I felt his pain a little bit. So, I mean, yeah, the wolves are a real problem, but I personally think wolves should be on the land, and that's what I learned. They should be there. I read a book called Shadow Mountain by a woman named Renee Askins, who we also wanted to include in the book. However, she wrote that book about 20 years ago, but it's about her mission. She's perfect for the book. She had a mission and a dream to help with the reintroduction of the wolves, and she almost single-handedly made it happen. And when I read that book, my heart broke for the wolves. So I fell in love with wolves doing the book. How about that?
There is something that comes through this book and that seems to be a theme that's sort of going on many different levels today, if you really look at it, and that is the theme of profound interrelationship, and not just like spiritual, we are all one, but really kind of biological and ecosystem. We are all very much a part of this, and to think of ourselves as separate ultimately doesn't work very well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think several people speak to that. And Terry Tempest Williams, for example, speaks absolutely beautifully to the interconnectedness between the landscape and humanity. Most people do. I mean, the words, the eloquence of some of the people in the book are just absolutely beautiful. And I'm not crediting myself at all. These people are speaking their truths, their passions, their feelings, and they're just beautiful. They're just, I don't want to sound trite, but they're stunning people. Stunning people, and they represent our landscape so well.
The book is called Voices of the American West. We're talking to Corinne Platt, who is the co-author of the book, along with photographer Meredith Ogilby, who we're sorry couldn't join us today. We weren't able to reach her, but she will be, the both of them will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this coming Saturday, the 30th of January at 2 in the afternoon. And the book is published by Fulcrum Publishing. Was it hard to get this book published, or what was the story around that?
It was a little bit hard. We sent it out to several publishers. We sent it to 10 publishers. It wasn't finished. And actually, I received handwritten letters back from all the publishers who said, we love the idea of the book. It's great. It doesn't fit our, unfortunately, it doesn't fit our needs. And several of those publishers gave suggestions on who we might contact. And then we had a publishing contract with Northland Press out of Phoenix, or Flagstaff, Arizona. And what, as we were getting underway with them, they were sold. And that publisher helped us find Fulcrum Publishing and get us our contract. So it took a little longer to get published, but I have to say the whole process and working with Fulcrum was amazingly easy. And it was such a positive experience, I think, for everybody. It was great. I don't have any of them. I'm not a writer who has all these horrible publishing stories.
Right. Well, it's a wonderful book, and I hope a lot of young people get to read it, because this is really the story of their elders, and some young people are featured in the book also. There are some high school students and things like that.
Absolutely, and that's what we hope the book is, really. It's a compilation of oral histories, and it should be timeless, and I agree with you. I hope young people are able to read it, and I hope it makes it into some college curriculums as well, because we can all learn from our elders. We know that.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Well, Corinne Platt, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you at Garcia Street Books.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find me at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.